Case number 13-7072 et al. Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Commission versus Reliable Limousine Service, LLC et al. Appellants. Ms. Strickland for the appellants. Mr. Lehman for the appellee.
Ms. Strickland, good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Elise Strickland and I represent the appellants in this matter, Your Honor. The issue in this case is whether the district court had jurisdiction to add a party, a new party, to a final injunction order that was on appeal.
That assumes that Reliable Limousine was not covered in the original order.
That's right.
What does Rule 65D2 say about the coverage of an injunction?
So Rule 65D2 says that you can't use basically an instrumentality. You can't use another entity or another person to aid or abet or to violate an injunction. And what Judge Huvel had said in her order was basically that the second entity, who is not a party to the case, was in privity with Mr. Rodberg.
You talked about in privity, but the rule actually has language on the subject, right? Other persons in active concert or participation with anyone described in subsections above who are party, right? Are you saying that Reliable Limousine was not in concert or participation with
Mr. Rodberg?
Rodberg, right.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Wasn't he the sole, the owner, the proprietor, the everything of RLBS as well as RLS?
Yes, but the fact that somebody
operating the same business under the same website, as I gather from the record.
Well, no. So I think that what's a really important fact in this case is that the second reliable entity had been formed and was in operation and had hundreds of employees way before this injunction was ever, way before the lawsuit was ever started, way before the injunction was ever issued.
Sorry, how does that shed light on the matter? That precludes its being in active concert of participation with the principal?
Well, because Mr. Rodberg certainly did not start Reliable as an entity in order to get around an injunction.
But the rule doesn't require that.
That's right. The rule doesn't require that. But if the court...
You might say that would make a real slam dunk.
Well, but if the court were to hold that any company that... And this is a company that abides by legal formalities, that has employees, that has separate everything. So we're not talking about alter ego. We're not talking about anything like that in this case. But if the court were to hold that the district court or any court could simply add a party,
Your formulation assumes the conclusion, right? There's no adding a party if, under the rules, the injunction initially covered Reliable Limousine.
I understand that. I think that that's right.
So there's no adding a party. The primary question is, what's the injunction mean?
Well, I think the...
And the rule tells us it includes persons in active concert or participation with persons described explicitly, such as the parties.
I understand that. And I agree that that's the law, but I don't think that the rule should... The rule implies that you can take an entity and without any service, due process, any discovery or trial, and say, we're going to say that this entity is acting in privity with this other person solely because he is in control of this entity. And that's the only evidence. When you look at the record...
So you don't dispute that RLBS was an agent of Rodberg? Was in fact, you said because Rodberg is in control. Rodberg is indeed in complete control of RLBS. Is that not the case?
Rodberg is the sole shareholder and president.
And in complete control of RLBS.
Yes.
Yes. And so the question is, there's a legal formality that makes RLBS a legally distinct entity. And it would be helpful if you had any legal authority for us that made clear that such an entity should be treated as a separate party for purposes of an injunction, given the language of Rule 65 about the scope of an injunction, concert, and participation. Are there cases that you haven't cited that are to the contrary? Or?
Well, there's no case that I haven't cited to the contrary, I mean, that I know of, but I think that what's important...
And your best authority on that point? That an injunction doesn't run to the corporate separate entity agent of an individual who the injunction covers is?
Well, the best case that we have on that is our case, the master-servant case law, where the court specifically says that you can't enjoin a servant in order to get to the master.
But what about a master? If you enjoin a master and the master has one employee who is evidently involved in misconduct and one who was not a parent and therefore wasn't sued in the lawsuit, and the master is held responsible and the apparent agent is held responsible, doesn't the injunction against the master prevent that master from then, while the injunction is enforced, turning around and saying to the non-apparent agent, hey, agent, you keep doing what it was that we've been enjoined from doing?
Yes, but what happened here is the opposite. She enjoined the agent to get to the master.
Rodberg is the agent?
Right. Rodberg, I mean, this is a company that was in operation well before this. And I think something else is very important here. Judge Huvel said, you know, on the record, to the commission, why didn't you just sue the right company to begin with? Now, basically, we have to fix this. So Judge Huvel understood at the beginning, as we all did, that the agency simply sued the wrong company that was in existence and that it knew of. There was no secret here.
I don't see Rule 65B creating some sort of false standard in the party that sought the injunction. Does the relationship described there apply?
I think you're right. I think there's not a fault standard, but I think that you have to show more than the fact that one party who's enjoined is in control of another entity. There has to be more. And I also think that due process requires that the second entity is actually served, given notice, have an opportunity to have discovery, and have a fair trial.
Yeah, but if all those things are true of the person who's managing the additional, we'll call it, entity, how is there any due process problem?
Well, Judge Huvel herself said that the show cause order had to be served on reliable. And what she did was she verbally said to the attorney, you're served on behalf of Reliable, because you're here. There's not going to be any discovery. And we're going to have a hearing without discovery on whether on this privity issue. And I don't think that the court had sufficient record to find that Mr. Rodber was controlling Reliable such that it was a violation or fell under Rule 65D.
And was that an objection made that you or counsel for Mr. Rodberg made at that hearing? We need discovery on this?
Absolutely. We.
And what is the reasoning for why the discovery was never, the underlying discovery in 2012 over the beginning of 2013? There was zero compliance. There was zero effort to have the discovery deadline move back. It just seemed like it was being completely, to use the technical term, blown off.
Well, the first entity ceased, wasn't in operation.
But Mr. Rodberg was in operation.
Mr. Rodberg was the president of another company.
And was sued personally also.
And he was, right. But he was in the midst of applying for a license from the commission. So he was in the midst of doing everything that he had to do.
And he didn't turn around and say to the court and opposing counsel, can we postpone the discovery deadline because I'm in the midst of this?
I don't know.
No, but there's nothing in the record on that.
There's nothing in the record on that.
No.
No, there's not anything in the record on that. Thank you.
Before you sit down, would you put on the record, please, the response of your client to our appellate jurisdiction in the second case? We asked you to address it, and you haven't. Just put it on the record.
Sure. This court has jurisdiction because the injunction, the new injunction, was a modification, not a clarification.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lehman?
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Lehman, and I am counsel for the appellee, the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Commission, or WMATSE. I'd like to take issue first with one thing that opposing counsel said, which is that Reliable 2, or RLBS, was not given a hearing on the issue of privity. They, in fact, were ordered to be at the hearing conducted on October 18th, 2012, and they were represented by the same counsel that represented the appellants, and the district court made several factual findings after Mr. Rodberg testified. The district court found that Mr. Rodberg was the sole owner and officer of Reliable 2, and that he had the power to cease the unlicensed transportation operations being provided by Reliable 2. On this basis, the district court found that there was privity between Mr. Rodberg and Reliable RLBS, or Reliable 2. This finding of privity has not been challenged or appealed by the appellants. If I could then move to two, I think, crucial facts in this case. This case really began on June 21st, 2011. That is the date that WMATSE issued a cease and desist order against Reliable 1, ordering it to stop all unlicensed transportation operations. Any shuffling of functions between different corporations on or after that date ought to be viewed by this court as an attempt to evade regulation and regulatory orders. The second key point I would like to make is that the essential problem of this case is summed up very well in a 2009 Government Accountability Office report entitled "Reincarnating Commercial Vehicle Companies Pose a Safety Threat to the Motoring Public." What this report described is a situation where unsafe motor carriers would be ordered out of service by the U.S. Department of Transportation, but then the owners, drivers, and vehicles would reconstitute themselves as a new legal entity, get back on the road, and pose a threat to the safety of the public. The report described this process as reincarnating or morphing. The last point on this is
where is that in the record?
It is not in the record, but it is a government report, which I believe this court can take judicial notice of. But even if it decides not to do that, the concept is what I'm talking about here, this concept of reincarnating. And Mr. Rodberg is a serial reincarnator. I'm talking about Reliable 1 and Reliable 2. But in reality, the record shows that he is the sole owner and sole officer of 8 separate transportation companies, all with the word Reliable in their name. You can find that, by the way, not in the unilaterally compiled joint appendix, but in the district court filing document number 32-3 at page 7. With regard to the law, the district court was well within its broad jurisdiction when it determined to assess a default judgment as a sanction for Mr. Rodberg's complete defiance of his discovery obligations, as well as the court's own discovery order. The court was faced with a factual scenario here that is a little unusual because this is not a case for damages. Womatsi was seeking injunctive relief. And so given that, Womatsi is charged with protecting the public interest and public safety by licensing and regulating motor carriers. When Womatsi was seeking an injunction to stop the unlicensed transportation operations by Mr. Rodberg, the reality is each additional day of delay in this case was a victory for defendants at the expense of public safety. So the trial court was faced with a crucial decision. Does the district court extend the date for trial, granting that delay and granting victory to the defendants? Or does it force Womatsi to go forward and prepare for trial without the benefit of the discovery to which it was entitled?
Mr. Lehman, why didn't Womatsi seek a TRO or a preliminary injunction, either at the beginning of the case to protect the public safety and or at least as the first line of action on the intransigence of Reliable?
I think the answer to that is that the decision makers of Womatsi understand the gravity of what they're doing. They are shutting down a transportation company, potentially putting employees out of work. I think the goal and the thought and the hope was that by filing suit in this case, Mr. Rodberg would get the hint and perhaps come into compliance, apply, obtain a license, and operate within the law, and this company would not have to be shut down.
And then when you were seeking sanctions, do you think it's legally available as a requested sanction instead of requesting default judgment to request the entry of a preliminary injunction at least?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
The sanction that Judge Chevelle ordered in this case was the sanction that you requested, and that sanction was a default judgment on the merits. And I'm wondering whether you think it's legally available to a party that has been prejudiced by an opposing party's failure to comply with discovery obligations to seek as a sanction instead of a default judgment that the court enter a preliminary injunction against the opponent that would be in place unless and until the discovery was forthcoming and a decision on the merits could be made.
Even though that sanction is not in the list of sanctions in Federal Rule 37B2, I think there is a provision that would allow the court, in its discretion of equity, to assess other sanctions, and that potentially would have been within the court's wide discretion. However, I don't think the court abused its discretion when it granted the sanction that it did. I would also point out that we're not just talking in this case about Rule 37B2, which involves sanctions for disobeying a court order. There is also Federal Rule 37D, which does not require any pre-existing court order, but still allows a district court to assess discovery sanctions where a party completely disregards its discovery obligations, as occurred in this case, where Mr. Rodberg did not provide a single piece of paper in response to document requests or respond in any way to a single interrogatory. Moving on real quick to federal appellate subject matter jurisdiction, I think even obviously this court needs to satisfy itself that it has such jurisdiction or it must dismiss the case. This is relevant to the second appeal, 13-7161. It's clear under the case law that This court does not have jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. Section 1291 because this is not a final order. There is no final order of the October 18, 2013 order is not final because the district court clearly contemplated that additional contempt proceedings would need to take place before a finding of contempt is reached. Given that, any decision on the second appeal by this court at this time would amount to an advisory opinion.
To decide, in effect, the issues that are posed in the second appeal in determining how to apply Philip Morris, in determining whether this was merely a clarification of an existing injunction? We have to basically decide whether RLBS was an agent and...
Yes, so under Section 1292A1, this court has jurisdiction if the injunction was modified on October 18th. And that is the exact same issue that's present on the merits of this appeal, modification versus clarification. What's different is in determining the threshold jurisdictional inquiry, Philip Morris and, more importantly, Birmingham firefighters make clear that this initial jurisdictional inquiry is very circumscribed. Where a district court describes its own injunction, as it does here, as a its own order as a clarification, this court, of course, is not bound by the district court's labels of its own action. However, for a district court's clarification to be something more, to be a modification, the misinterpretation must be such that it leaps from the page, to use the words in Birmingham firefighters. In other words, this court is narrowly construing jurisdiction under 1292A1, lest the appellate courts be deluged with interlocutory injunction appeals. And that language comes from, I believe, Major versus Orthopedic. With regard to the actual merits of the underlying question, was this a clarification or a modification? What's true, if you look before the federal rules of civil procedure were adopted, and they were largely, 65 was largely intended to codify the existing powers of courts of equity. And in doing so, the case law, such as the 1945 Supreme Court of case of Regal Knitwear, makes clear that injunctions do not just bind the named parties, but they also bind those who would aid or abet the named party, or who are illegally identified with the named party. That brings us back to this finding of privity in this case, the legal identification of Mr. Rodberg and RLBS, which has not been appealed. I see my time is up, so if there are no further questions, I would urge this court to dismiss the second appeal and to affirm the district court's rulings in the first appeal because it was not an abuse of discretion.
Thank you. Does Ms. Strickland have any time left? All right, why don't you take 1 minute?
Just wanted to point out two things. One is to get back to your question, is that we did cite in our brief the several cases, the RDK case and the doctor's case, which basically says that, and I quote, the mere fact that an employer-employee, master-servant, or principal-agent relationship without more does not necessarily satisfy the standard of person in active concert, at least where the consequence would be to extend the injunction to cover the dominant party. If it did, one would never need to obtain jurisdiction over a principal in order to obtain a binding injunction over her. It would be sufficient to sue and enjoin her agent.
That's the reverse, right? That's the reverse of the situation here. Right?
That
in that Rodberg appears to be the principal.
Well, it's an interesting question about whether he's a principal or an agent, but you can look at it as he is the servant, he's the employee, and the company is the principal. But I think that what the court was saying here is that you can't enjoin a person and then instead of enjoining the entity that's actually doing the act. And that's what they did. They wrote an injunction that enjoined Mr. Rodberg, but did not enjoin the entity that was in existence and that was acting instead. And the second point is that Mr. Rodberg was trying to obtain a license for Reliable, the second Reliable entity. He was doing everything he could to obtain a license. The commission was repeatedly denying his petitions for a license, which was on appeal.
You said he'd been in operation, the Reliable Limousine had been in operation for years. That's the way you started your argument. Is the license supposed to come before the operations?
Well, you can get a preliminary license. He had applied for that. Reliable hadn't been in operation for years, but it had been in operation prior to the lawsuit against the Reliable entity that the commission sued.
Without a license?
Pardon me?
Without a license.
The license application pending. And the denial of that license was appealed to the Fourth Circuit during this entire proceeding at the D.C. Circuit. So we had two things happening at the same time. So he was certainly not just thumbing his nose at the commission. He was doing everything possible to try to get a license, and he has a separate argument regarding why the commission is not giving any entity that he has a license.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.